On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. LA's in a drought, and yet experts believe the region could capture all its own water, as long as you are part of the solution. Hear just how, coming up.
The old infrastructure system was built with people being the problem, the polluters and the victims. This one takes us to the new day where we are all participants, where we're all managers of the water.
That's Andy Lipkis of Tree People. Hear from him later. Recent shootings in Paris and Colorado and San Bernardino have added to growing jitters about the risks of simply gathering in public space. Last week, the New York Times asked its readers, how often do you think about the possibility of a shooting in your daily life? The paper got thousands of responses, from people worried about dropping their kids off at school, about going to the movies and other perfectly normal daily activities. So we wondered, what does this mean, if anything, for our public space? Do architecture, planning and technology have a role to play in accommodating these fears? We asked three people expert in urban planning and got the following answers. First up, Susan Silberberg. She teaches urban design and planning at MIT, and she's principal of a design company called Civic Moxie.
Yes, I think we will see some physical expression, whether it's human expression. I'm thinking of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, where law enforcement was out in much more, in greater numbers than usual. But it's important to note, so were the crowds. And we will see other kinds of manifestations in our physical environment. Some of it will be around technology and surveillance, but some of it will be architectural design elements as well. And it's going to be a combination of a number of things. I do think it's important to note, and I've certainly seen this in my research and the changes in public space post 9/11, that it's very hard. You can't prevent these kinds of things. So all of these interventions in the physical environment, they don't deter attacks. What they do is they deflect them. And certainly saw it in my interviews with security officials in large office buildings in Boston. Their goal is to harden the target, to put up bollards, to put in metal detectors, security checks in their buildings, so that the attacker doesn't come to them but will go somewhere else.
You did look quite intensively at measures in Boston because you studied the 2013 Boston Marathon and its aftermath in terms of how people handled security. So when we think of something like the health center in San Bernardino, which is really kind of marginal, I guess, in terms of what might be a kind of desired target to find lots of people gathering, you're saying that's exactly the kind of space that gets deflected too.
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. And that we have, you know, we have a list of top terrorist targets, you know, in the United States. But the point is that that's, you know, just a percentage, a tiny, tiny fraction of a percentage of the spaces we have and where people are every day. And the reality is, I think the public really understands that as well. Recent polls, the Marist poll back in November, showed many more Americans are more worried about gun violence than they are about terrorism. And some of the big moves we've made in the physical environment around, you know, blocking off access to buildings for truck bombs and being able to do security screening around suicide bombers in buildings, it's much harder when you get to the day-to-day of someone who's got a gun and who's angry. We're looking at trying to solve it at one end of the spectrum and ignoring the other end, obviously, which is, you know, how do we put some safety measures and controls on gun ownership to begin with?
That's Susan Silberberg. Wade Graham is a landscape designer. He's an adjunct professor at Pepperdine University, and he's author of a new book, Dream Cities, Seven Urban Ideas That Shape the World.
Fear has always been around. It's not new. We've had communist witch hunts and the fear of crime and minorities in the 80s and fear of sex offenders. And our space plays a role. These things get played out in our spaces. You remember in the 90s, there was this sort of, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 or something, but sort of high-profile child abductions. And it really meant that no American child ever walked to school again. And it was changes everything when people have these kinds of mass fears. So the question now is not whether the fear is new, but it's sort of what form is it going to take? And it seems to me that this has been a slow ramping up of the way we experience fear in our environment. And what we're going to see is the acceleration of trends that we already see. So the kind of securitization of architecture, you know, building more secure spaces that are more militarized in certain ways, like U.S. embassies or like the Green Zone. And this has been going on for a long time in the U.S. And Mike Davis talked about it in the 80s in Los Angeles, the kind of carceral universe. And we're also going to see, I think, more screening. You'll have to go through more screens. Maybe we'll get to that point where there are metal detectors at the movie theater. But I think we're going to see more pervasive and kind of insidious technologies being used as part of design space. You know, technologies of surveillance and security are sort of everywhere now. They're embedded in your phone. They're embedded in your car. And they're really embedded in your houses and workspaces. And I'm just reminded of the movie that came out last year called Ex Machina, about the kind of cyborg. But the wonderful design sort of Dwell magazine house that the programmer tycoon lived in, where everything was a question of identity. You were pre-screened for your identity, iris checks, and the whole house was a kind of thinking security machine. And I suspect we're heading in that direction. So it seems to me that we're going to continue embedding architectures of security in everything that we do, and they'll take as many soft forms as they take hard forms in terms of guns and screening and police and hardened buildings. And it's, you know, it's worrisome, this, because we've just gotten out of, as a society, the mode of the 80s, where we had really hardened neighborhoods, gated communities, very aggressive policing, militarized policing. And I think in the wake of the Ferguson, Missouri issue, we've seen people really backing away from that kind of hardening of public space. So maybe we're going to lose that ground now. It's something to worry about.
That was Wade Graham. Doug Sussman is principal of Sussman Urban Design. He's author of Los Angeles Boulevard.
We may be entering a new era. We don't know yet. But we have faced many threats in public space, not just from this particular brand of terrorism, but from homegrown anti-government terrorism and a variety of types. Obviously, the horrible events in Paris have magnified the threat, because Paris represents the whole idea of public space and gathering. Medieval cities in Europe in the Middle Ages put up walls because of threats. And finally, when that threat receded, Baron Haussmann in the 19th century was able to tear down the walls, demilitarize the city, open it up with boulevards, and virtually create the whole idea of a open public space with cafes and the kind of gathering that people need. So threats have always been there for cities, whether it's in drug-related crime in Bogota or Mexico City or politically motivated violence in Jerusalem. And I think right now the challenge, well, for politicians, but also for those of us involved in building the built environment in public spaces, is not to overreact. And I think as Americans, not to give in to our fears. We're all going to have to deal with that. I had to question bringing my own daughter to high school because of an apparently prankish related threat in the aftermath of San Bernardino, and it brought it home. We all are going to have to make these decisions about risk and security. The question is, are we going to give in to that fear?
You are an urban designer. Are you asked to think about this issue of accommodating fear of random attack in any of the design projects you're working on?
No. I mean, this is really, if you think about it, since 9/11, there has not been really a major attack. This has, to a remarkable extent, receded in American life and in American consciousness. I think the Paris attacks were so violent, so symbolically powerful and viscerally disturbing, that it's shaken up perhaps a kind of complacency that we may have felt. But I think generally what the goals and the projects we're working on is how can we get more people to come and gather and enjoy public life? There's, you know, the security concerns have really receded, and that's been wonderful. It used to be, you know, 20 years ago, the first thing you were asked to do was to put up a fence around a park or to light something to prevent crime, and that really led, and that has changed in the last 20 years. And I hope we don't reverse that, because it's important not only to create good public space, but it's important also that we maintain our determination to be able to freely gather in public space.
That was Doug Sussman, Wade Graham, and Susan Silberberg talking about how fear of random attack might impact the design of buildings and public space. Tell us what you think at our Facebook page at KCRW's Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, rain is the new gold as LA sets its sights on becoming water self-sufficient, with you as water gatherer.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Los Angeles exists thanks to imported water. That's the mythology and the current reality. But it doesn't have to be. And little by little, cities across the Southland are working their way towards something called water self-sufficiency. So how come? Before we get to how, let's jump to Paris for a bit of context. The negotiations at the Paris Climate Talks, aka COP21, are aimed at getting countries to agree on national plans to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. But it's at the city level that much of this work has to take place. And that's because half the world's population currently lives in cities, and 1.5 million more people are migrating to cities each week. Here's Matt Peterson. He's LA's Chief Sustainability Officer.
Yes, cities are responsible for up to 70% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the world, all the activity that happens in a city, all of the inputs that go into making a city work and thrive and run every day. So cities really have a responsibility to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and lead the way.
Add to the part cities play in causing emissions, cities are also vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. And in California, that's expected to mean more and longer periods of extreme heat, extended fire seasons, and shorter but more intense periods of rainfall. And then there's the impact of a worsening drought on our water reserves. Back to Matt Peterson.
So we're losing snowpack due to climate change. And not only have we had the lowest snowpack in decades, we know that going forward, even with a wet El Nino, we may not have the snowpack we need, and we're certainly not going to be solving the drought, even with a wet El Nino season. So we need to continue to conserve and really have long-term solutions so we get to 50% of local water supply here in LA.
That was Matt Peterson, LA's Chief Sustainability Officer. LA is doing its bit for energy conservation, but today on DNA we're going to look at water and the 180-degree change that's taking place in, I suppose one could call it, the philosophy of water management. To find out more, let's head to Pico Library. That's just a few yards from KCRW station in Santa Monica. That sound you're hearing, it's spray painting. Back in early November, Santa Monica's lead traffic painter painted a sign onto the walkway in front of the library. It consisted of a dotted line marking an oblong, and inside the line were stenciled the words, "Collected rainwater below here." It turns out this line marks the presence of a water cistern buried underground, invisible to people entering the library. At the scene was Dean Kubani. He's manager of the Office of Sustainability and the Environment for the City of Santa Monica.
This is a library. This is where people come to learn things, and they also need to learn where their water comes from, and that 12,000 gallons are under their feet right here that they're using to offset otherwise drinking water for flushing toilets and things.
Yes, that's right. The rainwater is collected in the cistern, then cleaned up and used to flush the library's toilets. It seems like a logical idea. but it was not embraced by everyone at the city, recalls the architect of the Pico Library, Hank Koning.
There's a concern about, well, you know, birds poop on the roof. We need to sterilize the water, but then we should really be saying, well, what are we flushing away in there? And there are people concerned about, well, you know, what if somebody drinks from the toilet? So the health department said to us, well, we should put signs up that this is not potable water. And I said, well, who drinks from a toilet? And they said, dogs do. And my response to that was, well, my dog's out of luck because it can't read.
For Hank Koning and his wife and design partner Julie Eisenberg, recycling rainwater is a no-brainer. But that's in part because they hail from Australia, which has some of the most stringent water conservation and capture regulations in the world. Now Angelinos, so long used to simply letting rainwater flow out to sea, are looking down under for ideas, back to Dean Kubani.
We just haven't been pushed as early. They had some really severe droughts about 10 years ago and had to deal with it. Now's our time. We're having to deal with it. And even if we have El Nino, that's not going to solve the problem over the long term. So I think this is the wave of the future, and it's great that we've got some really, I mean, it's basically low-tech ideas on how to solve this problem. We've got the solution right here. We just need to do it.
So Santa Monica has set itself a goal of being water self-sufficient by 2020, even as it continues to develop. And low-tech is key. You won't hear desalination being talked about much in Santa Monica. The city is expanding its current water treatment plant. It has plans for building a water cistern and for digging a brackish well, both just south of the pier. Planners are also considering tapping into the sewage pipes and capturing that liquid and cleaning and processing it for irrigation and other uses. Now, some of these concepts might make you go, ooh, which gets us back to public education and that ghost of the underground cistern at Pico Library. As we watched the paint dry and workers lifted up the stencils, a mother named Amy Levine, her 9-year-old son Spencer, and his two friends Colin and Brendan came along to check out what was happening.
Come here, boys. Do you have any reaction to this? Do you know what that means, that there's collected rainwater below here? What does that mean? What have we been going through for the past few years?
A drought.
That's right. So is it a good idea to collect rainwater? Think they're going to do with that rainwater?
Watering plants.
Actually, they're going to use it for flushing the toilets at the library. How does that sound?
That sounds exciting. Excellent. We are doing our part because we redid our yard, thanks to Santa Monica giving us some money to do that.
Would you ever consider putting in a water cistern or other forms of water capture in your house?
Sure. We put buckets in our showers and we water the trees with that. What else do we do, Spencer?
I have a STEAM class, and my teacher said that there's something called, like, thirsty concrete or something. You put it down, and then, like, when water goes in, it just sinks in right away.
I like the term thirsty concrete. You know, we've always heard the term permeable pavement, which I think thirsty concrete's a better way to go.
That's Marty Adams. He's head of LADWP's water system.
But there are paving methods, whether it's sidewalks or streets, that do allow for water to soak in.
Permeable pavement or thirsty concrete is used to reduce stormwater runoff. The stormwater filters into the ground, and in some areas it can infiltrate back into the groundwater. Deborah Weintraub is Chief Deputy City Engineer for the City of LA.
So one of the most stunning examples was done a number of years ago, which is the zoo parking lot in front of the main entrance to the zoo, where we piloted different permeable surfaces. So there's permeable paving in some of the parking stalls. There's porous concrete in some of the driveways. And then the whole parking lot is sloped to what are called vegetated swales, which are landscaped to be sort of natural filtration systems for the stormwater runoff.
So if you're planning on checking out the holiday lights at the zoo this year, take a look at the thirsty concrete underneath your feet while you're there. You could even try testing it with a few drops of your drinking water. Because if you think making the rain stop at LACMA's rain room is kind of magical, well, so is watching water disappear through concrete. Here's Gary Lee Moore. He's the city engineer at the City of LA.
For me, it's the only time I ever get to be a magician when we're able to pour water into the pervious concrete or the pavers and the water just disappears. So it's my opportunity to be a magician.
The city has a number of initiatives underway to help capture water, and some of these are small, but Gary Lee Moore says every drop counts. And that's a massive change from past water management, says Art Castro. He's a civil engineer with the DWP.
As engineers in school, we're taught to convey stormwater and get it out of your site, out of your facility as soon as possible, because it generally meant a bad asset to you. Now we see it as a resource. So now we want to capture as much as we can.
Art Castro is a guy who sees every storm that hits the Southland as an opportunity for finding new locations for water capture.
We actually take drives when it's raining and just look and try to figure out where there's flooding. We take those locations, we take them back to the office, and we try to figure out if there's a potential project that would alleviate, one, the flooding, and second, infiltrate that water into the groundwater basin that will eventually turn into our water supply.
So as everybody else is trying to flee the flood, you guys are just charging right out into it?
Yes, that's an interesting way to put it, but we are very happy when we see flooding. Just some water engineer talk.
Art Castro's showing us one of the department's bigger projects underway to collect rainwater and to get it down into the San Fernando Basin. It's at the intersection of Interstate 5 and Highway 170 in Sun Valley, and it's a 150-acre area called the Tujunga Spreading Grounds. The spreading grounds are essentially what look like big dirt pits.
The best way I could describe them is it's a big empty bowl, essentially bottom, sand, gravelly soils at the bottom. So it acts like a sponge. Anytime you put water into it, within a couple of days, the water will be fully infiltrated into the aquifer.
When it rains on the San Gabriel Mountains, the rain whooshes down the Tujunga Wash and into a concrete channel. So the DWP inflates a rubber dam, which stops the flow of water and diverts it into these spreading basins. Now a project to upgrade the spreading grounds is set to begin next spring. It's to consolidate and deepen the basins, doubling the amount of water that can be captured, cleaned, and fed into the water system. But that is still a drop in the proverbial bucket when you consider that the entire region used to be a gravelly soil sponge. And that, says water experts, is where you come in. Here's the DWP's Marty Adams.
There's so much land that's private land, and we really have to find a way to leverage private property, because the whole valley is built where we have most of our groundwater basins under the San Fernando Valley, and everything's built so it all slopes toward the street, and so we get rid of stormwater as fast as possible so we don't have flooding in our homes. We need to find a way to kind of tip society backwards and to slow that flow down and have the water stay on property and really soak in, very different than what we did when the valley was developed, you know, decades ago.
Getting water back into the ground also means a massive cleanup of the polluted groundwater basins that are in the valley, and that's in the pipeline. But meanwhile, off to a private home in North Hollywood, where on the very same day, coincidentally, that the city of Santa Monica was painting its water system sign, so the mayor of LA unveiled a new pilot program of so-called smart water systems called LA Storm Catcher. This is a city and county-led pilot program in which cisterns are being installed in the yards of up to 10 houses. They have sensors that monitor storm predictions, enabling water to be siphoned back into the ground through rain gardens to make more space for fresh rainwater. In the past, this rainwater would have been directed to storm drains and into the flood control channels that would rush it out to sea. LA Storm Catcher was created in collaboration with the organization Tree People, founded by Andy Lipkiss.
The old infrastructure system was built with people being the problem, the polluters and the victims. This one takes us to the new day where we are all participants, where we're all managers of the water, where we're incentivized to conserve, where we're given feedback and information so we can help manage it. But the smart cistern is right at the center of that, because everybody can be involved in managing that water and conserving it and using it for flood protection and all that.
The results of the LA Stormcatcher pilot program will be analyzed to see how these systems could be deployed at scale across LA. For Andy Lipkis, this project is another step on the journey towards a more ecosystemic design for the region that began 42 years ago with the founding of Tree People. He's been in the forefront of pushing water agencies to heed lessons from Australia. But his thinking about water management was crystallized 23 years ago when he got involved in supporting job creation efforts in South LA, and he realized there could be plenty of work in local water capture, installing cisterns and rain barrels and retrofitting gardens and streets to turn them into sponges for water.
The major pivot to really focusing was the Rodney King riots. And it was because it's when I learned how much money we were spending to bring water into Los Angeles and to get rid of the rainwater from a flood control perspective, and then the costs we were paying for polluting that water, that it was such a hemorrhage of cash, roughly $1 billion to bring in water every year and a third to half that to throw away the rainwater. And then what really tweaked me was when I talked to different agencies, nobody had an interest in capturing the rainwater because they all thought it to be too expensive. And yet we were spending so many hundreds of millions of dollars a year that if we captured it, it could mean jobs for chronically unemployed and underemployed urban youth. And that chronic unemployment was creating social conditions from crime to really a depressed economy. And I thought, wow, this is the true meaning of unsustainability.
That's Andy Lipkis of Tree People. But what about El Nino? Will all of this that we've been discussing today help capture the rainfall that's expected this winter? No, it won't. Will it enable us to be more water self-sufficient in the future?
Not only is Santa Monica within reach of 100% local water. The city of Los Angeles has a goal, the mayor has a goal of 50% local water. Tree People's committed to that, and we'd like to see that happen substantially within 10 years. But I was really honored to participate in a two-day workshop held by Caltech, and they brought some of the best minds in the world together to look at water in LA with the question, could we be 100% water self-sufficient? And the answer was yes. There are a lot of different pathways to get there, rainwater being one of them, water recycling being a huge one, water efficiency being a very huge one. Other tools on the table include looking at desal. The important thing is we can get there. The question is we're going to expend billions of dollars right now in emergency projects to fix our infrastructure. Our streets are part of the storm drain system. Our roads need to be repaired. We should never throw the water away again. But with the billions of dollars we're going to be spending upgrading all these different pieces of our infrastructure, the question is, what outcomes can those dollars create for us in terms of community health, in terms of jobs? How we spend the money has very different outcomes. And if we spend it together wisely, we move ourselves right within that beautiful realm of climate resilience and economic resilience and community health. And that is the option that we are driving for.
That was Andy Lipkis, founder of Tree People, concluding our look at LA's quest to become water self-sufficient. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. The show's producer is Avishai Artsy. It was mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNAblog and follow us on our Facebook page at KCRW's Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.
Design's a really loaded word.
Designing and building.
Postmodern stuff.
DNA.
Design.